Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 16, recorded September 6, 2011, N7 HPR and Arisat 1. Hey, everybody. Live or from a drive, Ham Nation is on the air. I think I've overcomplicated things.
So. I think you've been overthinking this.
I have. Ham Nation is on the air. Hi, everybody. I am Gary Pierce, KN4AQ, filling in for Bob Heil, who's still on vacation. And here across the USA is Leo Laporte, W6TWT, the chief twit himself.
Well, it's great to see you again, Gary.
And Gordon should be in the background somewhere. If we can keep his video up, we've been having a little bit of trouble. So we'll see if we can keep him.
Hello, that's Gordon. Always my problem. It must be the shirt.
Something's scaring that camera, and I think the shirt is a good guess.
And our third stalwart regular is George Thomas, W5JDX. Hello, George.
Yeah, good evening, guys. Good to see everyone tonight.
I like your mic flick.
Yeah, remember to get you up at the top of the show. I got to get one of those.
That's pretty
sweet. You made that yourself, right?
Yeah, that's my $2.11 shock mount.
That's amazing what you can do with a soldering iron, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, on tonight's program, we're going to talk to our guest, Steve Bible, N7HPR. Steve's out there in Phoenix, Arizona. Steve's involved with the ARIS program, and they've got a new satellite up that got thrown out of the space station a few weeks ago. And we're going to talk about that because it's still running up there. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. I believe our rundown calls for some email, and I think Gordon might have some.
I do. I have from Michael, whose call sign, now catch this, is Bravo Delta 5, Romeo Victor Slant 4. He's with AMSAT China. He says, hey, I tuned in. I love Ham Nation, and I am interpreting it in Chinese. But he says, do you have a written script? And I said, heck no. We have no script. We just wing it. So sorry about that. But we appreciate you translating it. He said he had hundreds of downloads once he got it into Chinese.
Isn't that cool? He put subtitles, Chinese subtitles, behind us. So you guys, we're talking in Chinese right now.
Cool. That is great. And Stephen Houston wrote me. He said he's waiting for his new call sign. He just bought a dual band handheld, but he doesn't have a clue what to program in it or how to find a local club. Well, at the VE session, we would have hoped that the VEs would have given him some club brochures. ARRL.org. They've got a club list of clubs by the zip codes. And the W5YI instructor Elmer program says, hey, call this 800 number and we'll match you up with an Elmer instructor and help you get those channels programmed in. Here's that number, 1-800-669-9594. And here in Southern California, our local ham radio dealer actually pre-programs the radio, so that's how we get them on the air. And finally, our last email, Nick, whose call letters are coming, he says, I'm big into internet. What handheld? Well, let me tell you, everybody has their favorite. These are ICOM D-Star radios, great on the internet. Here is the Yaesu VX8R APRS and the Kenwood. Leo's got one of these with a great little antenna.
Look at that. Here we are. Look at that antenna. That's great.
And that one is also an APRS radio. So from the major manufacturers, Kenwood, Yaesu, and ICOM, they have you covered. So keep those emails coming. And back to you.
I do like that.
Is that a circularly polarized antenna?
Something circular about that. I do like that ICOM because it has D-Star as well as a GPS and everything else. And here is Michael's website where you can see the Chinese version. I've got it right here, Alex. iHow TV. And don't you think Ham Nation looks just a little bit classier in Chinese?
It does.
I think that's very cool. Look at that. You can see eagles in Chinese. I love it.
I got an email too. You might remember my sign off from last week. I told you somebody was going to get mad at me. Bill, K1ATV, Bill in Mesa, Arizona, and that's Bill with one L. Bill, I'm paying attention. Bill with one L says that at the end of the Ham Nation that I hosted back with the Carol Perry, that was I believe number 9. At the end of the show, I said over and out.
Oh.
Bill says, and you'll find this a lot in ham radio. People get picky about the way we do things. Bill says those are mutually exclusive.
Mm.
Over means you expect a response.
Mm.
Out means that you don't. And so over and out means you can talk if you want, but I won't be listening.
I don't know.
Evidently, over and out is sort of a Hollywood's a Hollywood take on two-way radio communication.
It's a Broderick Crawfordism,
yeah,
we'll call it.
It could be.
Yeah.
It's a Dick Tracy, because I think he went even farther. 6-2 and even over and out. Remember that?
Yep.
So anyway, I think I'll go with the you can talk if you want. I'm not going to be listening.
I'm gone.
All right. Over the weekend, Leo, I heard a couple things on your show, The Tech Guy.
Mm-hmm.
You are the tech guy.
I am. And are you going to correct me now? Because I'm sure I did something.
No. I heard something I liked and something I didn't like.
Uh-oh.
And the thing I liked was that you were getting a lot of calls from ham radio operators who identified themselves as hams. And one of them even said, you've made it safe for hams to come out of the geek shadows.
Come out of their ham shacks.
You've done that. Yeah. So that was very cool. You get more and more calls from guys that they're hams.
Yeah.
And I love that you talk about ham. I thought if you're doing Ham Nation, you know, okay, you got your ham license and all that stuff. That's very nice. You talk about ham radio all the time.
Well, it turns out.
Serious?
Yeah. And I think one thing that Ham Nation's done, and you guys should be very proud of, is there are, and I think always were, a lot of hams in our audience, but I think a lot of them were hams who got their license as kids or young men and or young women and had, you know, let it lapse. And I think this has gotten them excited about it. And I get email every day now from people who say, you know, you got me excited. I'm going to reactivate. So I think that's
what's happening. Well, like Jim last week.
That's right.
The video.
Yeah.
So the thing I didn't like was that you're also talking about how you have not really gotten on the air yet.
Well, I have a good excuse. you want to hear it?
Well, yeah, okay.
Now, I don't anymore try. Because I want to thank Bill Hillendahl from the ARRL who came down here and Dave, too, and they now programmed my handy talkies for D-Star. So now I really don't have an excuse. But you remember, one of the problems we were having is that there's so much RF noise in this neighborhood, maybe in all of Petaluma, that I haven't been able to do any HF broadcasting at all. So that's kind of a disappointment. We're still working on a solution for that. But, you know, I could be using the little Comet UHF VHF, and I should,
yeah,
I should be doing a little of that.
Well, I know you're busy. So we give you an excuse. You're too busy.
At least I admit it. That I haven't really gotten on the air at all yet.
Well, what you need is a real close one-on-one Elmer to just sit you through some contacts.
We got Chuck just up the road a piece, and
we'll get him over here.
I'm going to go over there. He's a big DXer, and he's got a great DX setup. And I'm going to go over there, and he's going to show me some of the rules of the road for DXing because I think that's something I'd like to do.
Because you break the ice, and then it's smooth sailing. You've been on the air for so many years, and you're so cool and smooth about being on the air, but you're a little nervous about getting on ham radio, I think.
I am. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
It's scary,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, to be in control.
When you're a radio guy, you know what you're going to say. You know, it's 56 degrees in the city, you know, half past 8, or whatever it is. You know what you're going to say. You have liners. People tell you what to say. You have a topic, but on ham radio, it's just... rag chewing, yeah.
Well, you know, a good thing to do, and one of the things that we encourage new hams to do to help break that ice is that we have these things called nets.
I need to join
a little organized daily activity, and you don't have to say very much, and it's not exactly scripted, but it's close enough to being scripted. You check in, and then you listen to everybody else check in, and then everybody talks a little bit, and then it comes to you, and you can talk for 10, 15, 30 seconds or so, and then move on. So it's not like you've got to hold up your end of a conversation for a half hour. It's a good way to break the ice.
It's a very good advice. You know, I wish I could get down far enough to join Gordo's net, because I know you do a morning net, don't you, Gordon?
I do. We're on the air, and we call you every single morning, and I know as soon as we get a remote station at your station, you'll come through ICOM loud and clear.
You're on, is it 20 meters that you do your net on?
We do a 20-meter net, but the morning net is 40 meters, okay. 7.250.
That's right, yeah. Well, maybe if I could get an HF antenna up here somewhere, and somehow I'll be able to do that, because I really would like to join that net. And I've had a lot of invitations, and now that I have D-Star, I should be able to do some of those D-Star nets that I'm hearing from all over the country.
You'll be talking all over the country. Plus, you have all of Pacific on in another month from now, coming to watch you live and direct on Sunday. So you're going to have plenty of pals, Leo.
I better get going here. You know what? I really feel bad, and I want to apologize to each and every one of you. I've been getting a lot of QSL cards, eyeball QSLs, I guess, because they're watching the show, because I haven't been on the air. And I haven't gotten my QSL cards printed yet. So I've got the cards. We're going to send them out, I promise you. I apologize for not sending them sooner, but we're getting them printed up right now.
All right. My floor manager, Cliff W4FT, tells me we need to move along. So I guess we'll do that. You want to take a look at the Huntsville Hamfest?
Let's do it.
You got that video queued up?
I think we have the video queued up.
Yeah, you can just roll that. I'll do a live narration. There's just a little bit of background sound on it.
That was the one you guys don't have.
Oh, it's the one you don't have. Okay, so that means it's up to me, huh?
It's up to you.
Oh. And where would I get that?
Okay, if we don't have that, we'll just move on to Plan B.
Well, where would we have gotten that from?
Lynn had it last week.
Lynn has it. Did she put it on somewhere? No, we didn't. I totally apologize.
Okay. So let's move on to Plan
failure.
B. Yeah. At the Huntsville Hamfest, I had a chance to talk to a fellow that I believe you know, Eric Schwartz, WA6HHQ. Eric works for Elecraft, and Elecraft has a new toy that I predict that you'll get one of the first ones of. Not available until sometime late this year, maybe early next year. He'll tell you all about it. Let's just roll the video. So, Eric, you guys have a new product here, it looks like. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, we've got, take a look here, we have our Elecraft KX3 transceiver.
Now, that's just the little control head, right? How big is the radio?
Actually, that is the radio.
No, that's not the whole radio.
That's the whole radio. Here, I'll disconnect the microphone. That's everything. So basically, you've got an HF transceiver, batteries. Wow. You can put an internal auto tuner inside this. It covers from 160 to 6 meters in the basic unit. We're also planning a 2-meter internal module for it.
The battery just died.
I had this on for a couple of days. So batteries are getting low on this guy. I think we're down to, this thing operates down quite low voltage too. You can, we're down to 9.9 volts now, and it gets down below about 9.5 or so.
There's a lot of knobs and buttons and dials on there. It appears to be fairly full featured.
It's really like a full featured HF radio. You've got everything you need at the top level. So operating this mobile, for instance, I actually have a mobile mount that we'll be making for this, where you can actually clamp it, you know, up next to you visually, so it's right at your eye level. And use like RAM mounts to suction mount it to a window or whatever. We actually have a 100-watt stage that a little brick amplifier you can put underneath the seat of your car, things like that. So that'll be sort of neat, too.
And this is HF 160 through 6?
Yeah, HF 160 through 6, all mode, sideband, CW, AM, FM. Actually, it'll do data modes. It'll, like our K3, they're cleaning something up there. They'll do RTTY and PSK31. It'll actually decode it and scroll it by on the VFOB display, marquee fashion. And it'll also let you send in those modes. Actually, right now you can send with your paddle in the CW mode, and we'll convert it to RTTY or PSK31. It's more for fun, but it basically let you casually, you know, tune around and listen to stuff. It also has computer interface, so you can do all those directly through our computer terminal, too.
And what kind of performance? This is probably not the performance of a great big 100-pound desk radio, but how close does it come?
It's awfully close. The K3 is still our top-of-the-line performing radio, which has been really...
Which is not a 100-pound desk radio.
No, it's not 100-pound, but it's certainly in that same category of performance. The K3 has been topping the charts for the last 3-4 years. The K3 X3 is roughly between our K2 and K3 in performance. It actually will outperform most other software-defined radios, for instance. And one important thing is the KX3, this little guy, is a software-defined radio with knobs. Now, you can think about it, inside it's a software-defined radio with a knob interface on it, but we also have coming out of it a IQ interface, so you can talk to it with most of the software-defined radio programs out there. But we've also done additional design features inside on our receive side. We're high-performance guys, so we like to squeeze as much as we can out of any performance we do to take it really beyond what other SDRs have done in terms of dynamic range. And so really what it ends up as is still in that top 5 to 10 radio class of receivers. So I think it's going to be a very good radio out there.
What price point are we looking at here?
The KX3, we haven't set the final price for it yet because we're not in full production with it, but it'll be somewhere between $799 and $899,
wow,
in that range in the basic radio. And you can add options like this little Morse code paddle on the front or internal auto tuner and so on.
And the availability?
Right now, we're going into our field test with it in October.
So I can take this one and help tell you all about it.
No, this goes back to the engineering lab, actually, after I head back. There's only a few of these in existence right now. I have to pry them loose from our guys' hands to bring them out to the shows. But we'll be field testing these, it looks like, in mid-late October. And we build an initial production run of those for our field testers. They give us final customer feedback so we can get any remaining rough edges out before you get it as a final customer. And then we're hoping to have this thing in production in late December. So sometime in the late December, in the January timeframe, I think the first units will start shipping.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming by. Appreciate it.
Well, now, How did you get to be one of those field tester guys?
Yeah, no kidding. Did you tell Eric that Leo Laporte would be watching this?
He told me that. Were you like roommates or it was college?
We weren't roommates. And that's just so funny because my college roommate is sitting right across from here, Bill Keene. But Eric was the radio station manager at the college radio station while I was the program director. We ran that radio station for a couple of years, WYBC in New Haven. And even then, he was kind of a geek. He was building a kit computer. I mean, this is 1976. He was building a kit computer in his room. We thought, boy, that's pretty geeky. And I guess he's still kind of doing the same thing. He started a hard drive company called Mountain Computer, and he's been a very successful entrepreneur, and I think he's done a great job with Elecraft. I think it's got a very good reputation. That's what I'm told.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's blown everybody away. And
I love the paddle on this thing. That's an option. But I think that's hysterical. You're driving along in your car and you're sending Morse code, or as Gordo likes to call it, Morris code. And your wife is right, by the way. Susie's right. It is. You do say Morris code.
I'm predicting Morris. You end up with one of these
It's pretty cute. It's pretty cute, I have to say. I might. That seems to be, the chat room was guessing. They said, $1,500. $799 or $899 sounds like a pretty aggressive price point for something like this.
Yeah. Yeah, the options will boost it up a little bit. Now, 100-watt amp will take it up a few $100, I think,
sure,
probably. But
it's 10 watts PEP, as is.
Yeah, still competitive. And batteries inside. So with the 10 watts, that's a good QRP power. You could dial it down if you want to be a little bit more QRP conservative and carry it with you, and a high-performance radio out there in the field.
Yeah, I love that. Very cool. You think that'd be the kind of radio you'd use for field day, maybe? Or do you HF on field day?
Field day is just about all about HF. There is VHF on field day, but more HF. A problem, it might be a good field day radio. It depends on how good the receiver is, because the thing about field day is that you have multiple stations in a confined area on the same band. Mm. You have a guy, if you're operating 20-meter phone, you've got a guy operating 20-meter CW and maybe a guy operating 20-meter teletype or digital modes just within a 1,000-foot circle. That's tough to keep those signals out of your receiver. Yeah. So if the receiver is good enough, then yes, and we'll find out. It'll be a good field day radio, but a really good field radio.
Got it.
No matter what.
Looks cool.
So, let's see. Gordon, I think we need to squeeze in the stumper because people are going to want to see if they got the answer right.
I think that radio is going to do fabulous. Probably not at a field day setup, because field day, you really want to have that 100 watts. But for the backpacker, especially working on the little built-in battery pack, man, it is going to be neat. We're going to see that, Elecraft, this coming weekend at a local ham radio convention called HamCon here in Torrance, California, this weekend.
Great.
Yeah, excellent. It'll have a crowd.
We'll have a crowd around.
Now, what was the stumper from last week? Because I don't remember that stumper. Maybe it stumped me.
It stumped me.
Okay. The stumper was, and Zeus has got to help me demonstrate. The stumper is when we take a tube, a conductor, and pass a non-magnet through it, it just drops right on through.
Right.
But when we take a magnet and pass it in the tube, and you can watch it carefully, we'll drop it through, and it will take its time. And we had one of our listeners and viewers, Lewis, KI6YWX, says, that's Faraday's law. A magnet in motion creates a magnetic field in the conductive pipe. And then Lenz's law is the falling magnet creates a magnetic field developing eddy currents. There's the secret, which oppose a magnetic field and effectively slow the fall of the magnet. And that's why for grounding, we always use copper foil, and we also use wide conductors. Mm. We never ground using wires because grounding with wires would many times create eddy currents and not allow that grounded signal to get to where we want it to go. And now here is this week's thumper, brain thumper, and you've got to listen to this one. At Irene, a mobile command vehicle pulled up, and everybody said, whoa, there's so much noise coming out of your vehicle on high frequency, none of us can hear anything. And here is the noise, and let's see, for those of you who can figure out what this noise is created by that mobile command unit, and it occurs a lot on boats as well as RVs and fifth wheel, what is this noise? Sounds like code.
Yeah.
It's not Morse code. So the question is for this week's Brain Thumper, what was that interference coming out of motorhomes and boats that go about 200 to 300 yards? What's creating the racket every 20 to 25 kilohertz?
There's a lot of guesses in the chat room, but I'm not going to say any of them out loud. If you want to make a guess, is there an email address we are using?
That's right. Brain Over Matter goes to WB6NOA@ARRL.net, and we will announce the first one that gets it correct. And there's a brand name associated with this awful noise, and luckily it's now been cured in future units. But what is creating that terrible noise?
There's a specific brand that creates it. That's a good clue, Gordo. You've given us a clue.
Do you remember my bonus question from last week?
No, I don't. What was it?
This thing up here. You thought I was a Marantz receiver?
Yeah.
And a few people felt waxed very nostalgic about that. That is a Sears 10 transistor, 100 milliwatt CB base station.
Oh my goodness.
An AM receiver.
Oh my goodness.
From the 1960s.
Wow. It looks like
a lot of hams got into ham radio through the root of CB. CB doesn't have a really good reputation among most hams, which is kind of dumb because so many hams went through CB to get into ham radio.
Right.
Not just the 100 milliwatt, but the 5-watt radios. And I did that well before the trucker craze and the good buddies and stuff, back when we used call letters and our real names, not handles. So that is a 10-transistor Sears base station.
Looks like it is something out of a Gemini spacecraft.
It is. This down here is my ICOM 756 Pro 3. The 10-transistor Sears base station is bigger.
That's good. So I'm glad people knew that one. That's great.
Yeah. We're going to get into our conversation with Steve Bible in just a second, but I want to toss it over to George to do just a little tease on what we've got for Smoke and Sounder coming up. So if I haven't caught him running out to the bathroom or something, George, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, Gary. And here's the tease. This is what we'll be talking about tonight. It's the finished regulated DC power supply that I started on a couple of weeks ago. And I will tell you that it worked, but that's all I'll tell you about it for right now.
I have a feeling there'll be video.
All right. We'll find out in just a minute. And now, Leo, Gordon, I want to introduce you to Steve Bible, N7HPR. Steve's in the Phoenix area, and let's see if we can bring him up on Skype. Hello, Steve. Do you copy?
Well, there we are.
Hey, hi, Steve.
Hi, guys. Hey, Gary, how many transistors in that ICOM?
There are more than 10.
100, I'm sure.
I think that should be the stumper question.
Is well, Ray's out there.
How many transistors are inside that?
Do you include Ray CPUs? Novak.
Ray Novak is out there in the chat room.
Right? Sure.
Okay, now I'll say hi to Ray. Hope things are going well. Hope to see him soon.
So we're going to talk about the ARRIS program and the satellite that's up there right now, the ARRISat-1, in just a second. But I want to introduce you a little bit more, or let you introduce yourself. Tell people a little bit about who you are and how long you've been a ham, and maybe what you do for business and stuff. Because what I wanted to do was introduce people in a little bit broader context than just ham radio. So because we're hams here on the show, but we're more than that. So a little bit about Steve Bible.
Okay, so yes, I'm a ham, and yes, this is my shack here.
It's like a bookstore.
That's just half of it. There's so much to say. I'm just trying to keep it, manageable.
When did you get your license?
Okay, so I got my license in 1985, so I've been a ham now for a little over 25 years. Definitely was really interested even when I was a kid in grade school. We had an English teacher that we had to get up in front of the class and do our different talks, and we got to choose whatever talk we wanted. So I was talking about electronics, and this is all the way back in 7th and 8th grade. And so it turned out the English teacher was a ham, so he took me under his wing and after class and taught me the Morse code. But as it is, when you're a young kid and it's hard to concentrate, especially back then, as difficult as the exam was. And, of course, living in Phoenix, the FCC didn't come here until every 6 months. And that was to go downtown and to take the exam. So it waned until I was in my 20s before I got my ham license, but it was definitely a seed that was put in me in a very early age.
And what do you do for a living? What's your... you're in technology someplace, I know, but I'm not sure quite where.
Okay, so what am I doing today? Well, for the past 11 years, I've been an applications engineer at Microchip Technology. So a lot of people might be familiar with Microchip. They're the ones who make the PIC microcontrollers. Maybe a lot of the hams out there have done projects using with the PICs. There's been several articles in QST and QEX even about how to use the PIC microcontrollers. They're really not very hard to use at all in ham projects, and a lot of people find them very easy to pick up on and add them and make their projects even smarter. In fact, those Elecraft radios, so here's a stumper question for you. How many PIC microcontrollers inside an Elecraft? And you can choose which one, the K1, the K2, or the K3.
Well, I would have to say there's probably a bunch. Yeah. Anyway, how about telling us about the ARRISS program? I can't wait to hear more about it, and I think we've got some great pictures to go along with it. Go ahead.
Okay. The ARRIS program is Amateur Radio on the International Space Station. So what maybe a lot of hams may know, or perhaps those that are watching the program may not know, is that there's an amateur radio station on the International Space Station. It's the first one is part of the Russian segment, and there's a second one now that's part of the European segment. So way back when the International Space Station got started, we put together an amateur radio station, which consists of a handheld radio, and also there's a packet up there. ARRIS also went on to do satellites, and one of the first of those satellites was SuitSat-1, which was launched in February of 2006, and I think we've got a slide for that one. And there it is. And you can see on the right, there's SuitSat-1. It's a Russian Orlan spacesuit, and this is the real SuitSat-1. This is a photograph taken from the International Space Station with it all assembled, ready before it was deployed. And you can see on the top of the helmet, there's a little switch box, and you see the antennas that are kind of folded back on it. And what we did is we created the electronics that went inside and also the switch box and antennas that went on the helmet and made it into a satellite. And the picture you see on the left, that is actually the suit out in orbit. Now, there was no solar panels on SuitSat 1. It just operated on batteries and lasted for about 2 weeks. And it was nothing short of a phenomenon. The idea of putting electronics and making a spacesuit into a satellite was just too good to be true. There was just people all around the world were just fascinated by it and had the opportunity to listen to it. I'd say it was unequivocally a success, especially from the phenomenon point of view. From an operational point of view, it had a little bit of problems with the antennas and thus was not able to be heard on the ground with very simple handheld radios as we really intended it for to be. So it was discovered that the antennas weren't working quite right, then the guys then basically went into the attic and dusted off those Yagi antennas and pointed them up at the sky and were able to hear it. Now, I had a couple of URLs at the bottom of that slide, and probably the best one is AJ3U's blog there, that middle URL.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, AJ did a wonderful job. He basically collected everybody's audio recordings and their signal reports, and if you go to that blog, you'll start at the bottom and work your way up to the top. You'll get the whole chronology of SuitSat 1. Yep, there you go. And it's just, this is very well done. And we had a lot of fun doing SuitSat 1. And we wanted to do SuitSat 2, and we wanted to do it better. We wanted to, let's go back to SuitSat 1. It basically, the electronics in it was a simple radio transmit only. It was a receive only satellite. And we had basically FM. And it was audio greetings from space that we had recorded from children from all around the world. And that's what you got to listen to. And the telemetry was spoken, which also meant that, you know, a lot of the amateur satellites, the telemetry ends up being...
Amateur radio station, RS0RS. Hold it, Jorgen, hold it. Hold it, listen.
Are they speaking Russian?
Well, that one is a Russian greetings, and that's from,
wow.
If you listen, there's a Russian one in Russian, and there's another Russian one that's in English. So they were basically, the Russians love commemorating events, and that, I forget which one, the event that was.
This is the telemetry
you were
talking about.
There's also the children. Yeah, and then you'll hear the telemetry, spoken telemetry. The nice thing about that is you didn't have to have anything very sophisticated in listening to it, and that was our intent from the very beginning. Of course, we certainly would have loved for it to last longer, but not having got my tongues twisted there. We had a very short time of getting the electronics put together, so we didn't have the ability to put anything more sophisticated in it.
It was designed
to
be a first
try. Now, tell us about the new one. The one I just heard a couple of days ago.
Oh, good. I'm glad you heard it. I want everybody to go outside right now.
No, not right now.
Well, you're going to have to sit there and take a look and do the past prediction so that you know when it's going to come by. But when it does, then jump outside and point your antennas at the sky and have everybody wonder what the heck you're doing.
Are these old, unused suits that they're just kind of tossing out? Is that the idea?
In a way, it is. What's interesting is the Russian philosophy with their spacesuits is that they discard them after, let's see, it's 5 years or 12 wearings.
Huh.
Whichever comes first.
That's pretty quick, really.
Yeah, it is. And now the NASA philosophy, what's interesting about that is I'm sure they have a certain amount of wearings, and then they bring them back and refurbish them. So it's interesting now that you see the U.S. and the Russian space programs working together to see the two different philosophies.
Yeah, yeah.
So what it was is Sergei Sambarov, who is one of the members of ARIS, ARIS being the international community of people that basically care and feed for the amateur radio part of the International Space Station.
They just have me shut down.
Oops, sorry about that. We've got a little Gary crosstalk coming.
Gary, we're trying to work around you there.
Yeah, I'm back. Had a lightning hit.
Is that what happened? Ooh. We thought you sat on your mute button.
No, lightning hit. It knocked off my mixer, but I got it booted
up
again.
Holy cow. So you're in the middle of a lightning storm right now?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, you're brave.
You know, they say it's 5 o'clock somewhere, but I guess then there's also lightning somewhere as well.
Yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was trying to remember.
How about the new one? No, we heard the new one, and it seemed a lot stronger in signal strength.
Yep.
What's the makeup of it? Is it a box? Is it another spacesuit?
Well, you got a picture of it the way you had it set up in Dayton, right? You have a picture of the way it was set up at Dayton, which is kind of an early mock up, I think. Number three.
We're looking for it.
Was the helmet. So what we want to do. This is suit set two. As we were working on it, we were going to use another suit. And to make a long story short, in 2009, we lost that suit. Not that it went missing or anything, but what had happened is
we had it here somewhere.
Yeah. Where is that doggone suit? The International Space Station, back at that time, they increased the number of their occupants to 6. So the astronauts and cosmonauts. So there wasn't. All right. So there. Get this. There's not enough space
for the International Space Station.
So they had to make room.
Did they throw it out, or did they send it down in a progress, or how do they get rid of it?
Yeah, they probably the progress is, of course, the UPS truck, the brown truck that goes up to the International Space Station and takes the supplies. And what they do is when they empty the progress, then they fill it back up with trash. And then when it's time for the next progress to come up, they detach it, and then it comes down to the Earth atmosphere and burns up. So they basically incinerate their trash, and they use the used progress as the dempsey dumpster.
So you had to go to Plan B.
Yeah, Plan B. So Plan B, let's see here. What's a good picture for Plan B? Why don't you go to number 5? And here's an artist's conception of suit set. Now, what you see on the top left there, there's that control panel that you probably saw on suit set 1. And inside this box are basically the parts and pieces that would have went inside the suit. So we ended up making a space frame. Here it is. And notice it has solar panels. So we have 6 solar panels in all, so you can count them. There's 4 on each side, 1 on the top, 1 on the bottom. And these were solar panels that were donated to us from NASA. So these are space-rated solar panels. This pretty much dictated the size. And so now, you're taking a look at that picture. What do you think the size is? How big do you think that is?
Oh, that looks like, I'm going to guess, maybe that's about 8 inches by 8 inches by 3 inches.
And you'd be wrong, Leo.
Oh, Leo.
Not for the first
time.
Any other guesses?
It's the size of a small home. I don't know. What is it?
Bring up slide 8.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And this might give you a little perspective.
Oh, it's a little bigger than that. Wow. Yeah. Look at the size of those handles. Wow.
Can you tell the listeners what frequency to tune in so everybody can go outside and listen to it?
Because Gordo's already heard this.
I know.
That's so cool. Frequency.
All right, so bring up slide 19.
Slide number 19.
19.
Probably
the easiest is on that top right end where it says FM, says 145.95. That's the easiest one. That is the FM channel where you'll hear the greetings from space, the voice telemetry.
Now, I could do that on my handy talkie.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Really?
So what you'll want to do, Leo, and for everybody out there listening, to get your handheld, and it does. Like Gordo said, we were much more successful this time. The antennas are working great. The transmitter's working great. And literally with an HT, with a rubber duck antenna, you can go outside and listen to Aerosat at 145.95. So bring up, I don't know, if, can we bring up the amsat.org website?
Yeah, this is where you'll find out when it's going to be passing
right.
overhead.
I have it right
remember,
now,
about
I believe,
a
yeah.
3 to 5 minute window, so you got to listen quick.
Right. So this is SuitSat 1. Where is SuitSat 2 on here?
Well, go to Launchpad. Now, on the top,
there it is.
On the top, where it'll say passes. Notice it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5
yep,
from the left.
I see passes.
And it won't be SuitSat 2. It's AeroSat 1.
It'll be AeroSat. Yeah,
AeroSat 1.
That it got renamed. Now, what you need to do is find out
what
your latitude and longitude are and fill that into the altitude there. Go ahead and hit predict. All right, so this is a pat. And what this will do is print out a table. Yeah, it probably won't let you.
I need it. Give me a grid square. I need a grid square.
Find out for me.
Yeah, Charlie Mike,
FM 05.
FM 05, you want to do that?
Yeah, that'll be for North Carolina.
There you go.
We'll see if I need to run out of rain here and go watch it.
There we go.
Yeah, see, what it'll do is it'll give you a table, and of course, it's in Zulu time or universal coordinated time, so you'll have to translate that for use. Now, Leo, on the view current location of AeroSat.
Let's
there on
where
the
that,
top.
That baby is here. Amateur Radio International Space Station SAT-1. And
there you
is.
Go.
So now, it looked like that had solar panels on it. Did it? Is that where you're getting your...
Yep. Well, the solar panels mean that it's operating now. Let's see. Tomorrow is Wednesday. It was launched August 3rd. So tomorrow is September 7th. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. It's been operational 5 weeks now.
That's great. Now, I saw that battery life on it was less than you thought. So, but it sounds like it's doing all right.
Yeah, it's what's happening is the battery has failed.
Oh, all right.
That failed 8 days into the mission. Well, there's a little story behind that, and it's kind of a long one, but I'll try to make it short. But it is a silver-zinc battery. This is the same type of battery that's used on the Orlan spacesuit. So that's naturally the battery that we were given. Well, if you study that chemistry, there's one of two ways to build that chemistry. One is reliability, which is the way this battery was built for the suit. And the other is longevity, which it was not built for that. So this battery was only rated for 5 charges. So we thought if we did shallow charges on it, we'd be able to extend its life. Well, we find out now that it only lasted 8 days. So we need to regroup and think of another idea of what we can do for battery power for the next satellite.
But as long as you're in sun, you can operate.
Absolutely. And the panels are generating enough voltage and current to power the whole satellite. So what happens is if you're doing that past prediction that you saw on the AMSAT website and it's nighttime, chances are you're not going to hear the satellite. But if it's daytime, then it's powered up.
So you're looking for a daytime.
No wonder.
Yeah. You got it in the morning, right, Gordo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
what's interesting
sense.
Is when it comes out of eclipse, okay, when it comes out of the dark into the day, there is a 16-minute safety timer. So what happens is once that voltage gets back up to where the system will start up, that safety timer, 16 minutes, it'll be quiet. And the reason why that timer is there is that's what we designed it for the cosmonauts to be able to turn on the switches, have a 16-minute window of safety where the satellite is not transmitting, and they were able to get it pushed off. So what happens is every 90 minutes, AeroSat orbits the Earth, and as it comes out of eclipse, it takes 15 of those minutes to be able to go through the safety timer timeout, and then start transmitting.
So typically we're talking between 6 and 10 minutes of time that you could actually hear it for any given pass.
Yeah, and really if it passes right over your head, 10 minutes is probably the most prime time. But don't be discouraged. If it gets above your horizon by a couple of degrees, people are still hearing it. So if you have a 5-minute pass and it passes kind of shallow from horizon to horizon, chances are still very good you're going to hear it.
Great.
All right. Well, that we'll send George up maybe to solder on. Well, no, we better keep George down here, huh, Leo?
Well, he's got a power supply.
He's not afraid to use it either.
Maybe need a longer power cord, but we'll give it a try.
This is just, I think this is really a great example of kind of citizen science. I just love this idea of taking these old suits, or in this case, building something. How do you get that? How are you going to get that up? Do you just send it up on the Progress? Or
yeah, that's it. Went up on the Progress at the end of January. In fact, we were thought that
Let's
they were going to deploy
picture number
it in
17
February.
Is of the launch. Picture 17.
Yeah, there's some good pictures there. There on the left, you see Look where they've packed it. Actually, the top right. They've basically wrapped it in a protective wrapping, and they're lowering it inside the capsule. And the picture on the left shows it tucked in nice and neat inside the capsule there. And on the right is the Progress launch. So that went up January 28th, and we thought it would be deployed in February. They delayed it. See, what the Arisat or SuitSat, or even also it's known as RadioScaf, which is the Russian way of saying of a satellite experiment, RadioScaf, is technically it's a Russian experiment, the whole satellite. So we built this and then shipped it over to Russia, courtesy of NASA. It's all part of the educational program within NASA and, of course, the educational mission that ARIS has. And then the Russians took it from there, putting it on the Progress. I learned a new term. It's called up mass.
And there's a lot of it, I bet, on the thing that big.
Yeah, that's that. So it's, you know, up mass. So you don't just send it up there or deliver it or mail it. You up-mass it. So it was up-massed in January, sat there, and there's some pictures on the net you'll see where the cosmonauts have taken pictures of themselves with a satellite. And
great.
Then come a Russian EVA, which was on August 3rd. Then this is where Arisat was taken out. And there's some really good video. Now, the video that Gary's got, the problem with this launch, if you go to launch 20, is this is the recording. This is the audio recording of the cosmonauts deploying the satellite. But the video wasn't there because the International Space Station was in between relay satellites and we didn't have a video feed.
Yeah, you see a little bit of it, and you can hear them talking about pushing it out. This runs a minute or so. You can bring up the sound full for a second.
It looks like it's been broken.
This is Mission Control Houston, as you can see from this.
Now, this is kind of curious. They're talking about
the Arisat RadioScaf educational satellite that we've been talking about since the beginning of today's activities. The crew is getting ready to attempt another deploy of this. And they are still discussing this second antenna that is in question. The satellite will be deployed off the back end of the station. There's about a 30-degree cone that it will stay in as it drifts away.
This is the time that you have to jettison.
That is the...
get crazy here, but you need to work quickly. I just wanted to let you know that you have less than 3 minutes.
I just love the commitment.
The space station is quickly approaching sunset. They want the crew to get the satellite deployed before the sun
I mean,
goes down.
The commitment to education that this requires is very high-tech operation.
The deploy should take place within the next 2 minutes.
Absolutely.
They're about to push it out here. They're about to push it out.
Yes, it's moving beautifully. Very nice.
That's so great.
You have to picture it going away beautifully.
I have some other video here. This is a video from the website also. I think it's coming out right there, isn't it? That's the satellite right in the middle there. Boy, that's
amazing. And it is. What had happened is earlier on in the EVA, the extravehicular activity, otherwise known as a spacewalk, see, they brought... there you see they're bringing Arisat out of the hatch.
Yeah.
This is the PIERS docking module, which is basically the chamber that they do the depressurization so they can step outside. Here they're removing the protective wrapping. And then we're watching the video live. Now, I'll tell you what. Them doing the EVA with the helmet cams was just phenomenal.
It's great to watch.
You know, you're seeing this firsthand. It's first Amazing. Person. You can see their hands. Now you can see why we made those handles so big.
Yep.
All right.
It doesn't weigh much, but they've got big old gloves on, and they need to hold on.
Yeah. On Earth, it weighs a little over 50 pounds, but there you can see they can kind of toss it around pretty easy.
It's got some mass, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Now, one of the things that a lot of people saw that and saw, man, look how well they bumped it and bounced it around. Well, you know, that's our job. When we design it, we have to design it in such a way that, you know, it can take that kind of abuse. We have to think of these things and make it. So
it's part of the challenge. There it goes.
Well, it's not going to go. No. It's actually on a tether there. Uh-huh. And for what it was is they discovered that the uplink antenna, the 70-centimeter uplink antenna, was missing. And we could see that in the helmet cam. And the cosmonauts thankfully saw it too. So we did think that they were going to basically bring AeroSat back in and launch it another year. In fact, the next time they were going to do an EVA was 2012.
Oh, geez.
So really what they did is, you see it there, it's actually on a tether. They left it there for a couple hours, and they went on there about their business doing the EVA. And they were trying to figure out what to do. And so they were going back down to the ground control, and what they were doing is the previous expedition, they were going around asking them, so where's those antenna? Where was the antenna? And they said, well, it wasn't there. And I think the decision was made to go ahead and let it go, so that about two, almost 3 hours later, they went ahead and deployed it without that antenna. So we thought, okay, well, we've lost the ability to talk through the satellite, because that was just the uplink. And really, you know, the whole mission's not totally lost. But to our absolute amazement, hams around the world are able to communicate through AeroSat, through the transponder, with as little as 1 watt on the uplink.
Wow.
So, I mean, mission
accomplished.
Sometimes
things go your way.
That is just so
often
cool.
Enough they don't, but sometimes they do.
Now, where does the funding come from for this, Steve?
They'll be hitting
you
up for
it. Well, it was okay, here's another amazing thing, is that satellite was completely designed and assembled and put together by volunteers.
Wow.
I mean, from hams, that's probably not as great an amazement, but, you know, for the non-hams or maybe those that are not aware of amateur satellites, you know, it was all done by volunteers. So they volunteered their time, their workbenches. I mean, my workbench right over here soldered many of the components that are inside that are up there in space right now. But you still have to buy materials. You still have to fund airplane flights, hotel rooms, you know, for the engineers and the volunteers going back and forth as we were working on it. And the bulk of that came from AMSAT. So I'm going to put a plug in for AMSAT. If you go to AMSAT.org's website, there's a donate button there. So Barry Baines, president of AMSAT, has said that this cost AMSAT $180,000. So AMSAT is, of course, a membership supported organization through dues and donations. So if you really enjoy SuitSat, then highly encourage you to donate to AMSAT in any way you feel, whether as simple as just becoming a member or, you know, sending a donation their way.
Look at that. They launched that out. And do you think it'll just keep going as long as you've got sunlight? I guess you don't need the battery. How long do you think it'll stay in service?
That's what we're doing. Now we got a Chicken Little contest going to find out when it's going to come back into Earth and burn up. So when it was deployed from the space station through that cone of silence, cone of safety, actually. Anyway, got to go all the way back to our Saturday Night Live.
I think that's Get Smart. I hate to tell you.
Oh, the cone of silence? I always remember is the cone heads on
Cone
Saturday
heads,
night.
Right. But Get Smart was the cone of silence.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back and watch my reruns.
I do believe you mean the cone of silence, Chief.
Oh, yeah. That's where you're going to end that movie. All right. What was the question I was asking?
How long it's going to last. So you're thinking the orbit does decay after a while. Yeah.
It is decaying. It was deployed down, which is towards the Earth. And for those of you who have read Ender's Game, the enemy's gate is down.
Mm-hmm.
So it was purposely done that way so that, you know, the satellite doesn't come back around and become a hazard to the International Space Station.
Got it. You don't want it in the same orbital plane as the ISS.
No, you don't. So it was purposely, I mean, they done a lot of simulations as to where it needs to be pushed, and they pushed it off in that direction. So it is decaying. It is coming closer to Earth. In fact, you can download the orbital elements from various different websites and do the prediction yourself. You can just run your satellite programs. There's several available out there for purchase and some that are free. And just keep running it and fast forward and see when it's going to come back in. What I hope is that the electronics maintain themselves. What I would hope to see is that the temperatures, we start seeing the temperatures go up and then to such a point that, of course, then temperatures get too high and it actually enters and burns up.
Right. This is really a wonderful project. AMSAT.org to know more about it. And I'm going to be pointing my handy talkie towards the sky tomorrow afternoon when it flies overhead. I already checked. And it's coming our way this tomorrow afternoon, so we're gonna try
Great.
And listen to this. So, what do I expect to hear? Will I hear telemetry, or
what you're going to hear is, and this is kind of interesting for this satellite's probably not quite as a phenomenon as SUTSAT-1 was. SUTSAT-1, of course, was just the interest factor was just right. way up there. This one, however, we've got people from all over the world listening to and operating through the satellite. So this one is definitely one of the most operated satellites. And you want evidence of that? Go to YouTube and just search on Arisat.
Mm.
And what people have done is when they've recorded mm-hmm. their passes and put them on YouTube. There is literally, I hadn't even looked here lately. There's got to be at least 100 or more up there. But anyway, when you listen, you're going to hear the this is Arisat call, the give its call sign, which mm-hmm. is a Russian call sign. It is a Russian experiment. And you'll hear the spoken telemetry, and then you'll hear a pre-recorded greetings from space. There's 15 different languages recorded on there. And each of those languages, each one of the greetings gives a secret word. So as a contest, you can collect all the secret words and turn those in and get a certificate.
Oh, wow. There's even a game. That is so cool. I mean, when I first heard about the idea of talking to an amateur satellite, I was very jazzed. But now this is even more cool.
Okay, so now you want to be really jazzed.
Yeah.
So this is the 50th anniversary of Oscar 1. Okay, so Oscar 1's the very first satellite that amateurs put together and launched, and OSCAR stands for Orbiting Satellite Carrying Amateur Radio. So it's an acronym. And OSCAR 1 was launched in 1961, and it was done by Project OSCAR, which is right there in California.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back to the AMSAT.
Well, let me just play. This is somebody with a handy talkie aiming it. You see, they have a little fox hunt directional antenna there, aiming it at the sky. And listen.
Battery voltage is
That's all you need.
5.90 volts. Battery current is -8.
That's the telemetry.
Right.
Coming back.
This is Arisat 1.
And there's the call sign.
Satellite RS-01S.
That is so neat. That's Chinese.
So see if you can hear all 15 languages.
Well, I don't think we need to listen to all 15. I just wanted to play a little bit of that to give people an idea.
The challenge is for you to go outside and hear them, not...
Not listen on YouTube.
You're not going to get a certificate. What I was going to say is, if you go to the AMSAT.org website, AMSAT is having their annual space symposium in San Jose early November. And Vince Ginner, I hope I got that name right. Let me look it up here real quick. Oh, Lance Ginner, K6GSJ, Kilowatt 6 Golf Sierra Juliet, is going to be the guest speaker. He's the one that worked on Oscar 1 and Oscar 2.
Neat.
Wow.
It's really a testament to the ham community, the volunteer spirit of the ham community, that they build satellites and they put them in space and you could talk to them. Just
absolutely
incredible. Just incredible.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to push things along too fast, but we have one more thing that we need to talk to Steve about, because he wears many hats, and one of them is something that's coming up in a couple of weeks in the Baltimore area. This is what I was talking about last week for the real blood and guts, high-tech hams, the stuff they talk about that, you know, I don't understand and you won't understand unless you are really good. And Steve has corrected me about that, so we'll find out. But Steve, tell me what is coming up in a couple of weeks in Baltimore.
Okay, so we're switching gears here now. And those mini hats, of course, I've been working with AMSAT for many years. But my other hat is I'm the president of TAPR, which stands for the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio, which is no longer really in Tucson and no longer really all about packet. It's more
kind of like KFC. It's just initials now.
Yeah, it would just rather just say TAPR, and of course, like the ARRL, they also want to use just the letters and not really go much for the actual name, because it just kind of goes back many, many years to its origin. But really, what it is today is an organization that promotes the advancement of the radio art, and mostly in a digital fashion. And this is to say, using digital techniques and digital modes. I mean, it's still, you know, HF, but you're going to use digital modes, and you could even say that, you know, CW and RTTY are digital modes. But TAPR has an annual conference that is the Digital Communications Conference. And it will be September 16th through 18th in Baltimore, Maryland. We're going to be at the BWI Sheridan, which is the Sheridan Four Points Sheridan that happens to be at the BWI Airport. So you don't even have to rent a car. You just basically land at BWI and walk over to the hotel. But for 3.5 days, we have technical talks, and we have a demo room. We have socials, we have banquets, and we have just a great time really getting down and dirty geeky. And what we do is we do a call for papers, we publish a proceedings, and we invite the speakers come and present their papers. And this is basically amateur radio experimentation. So this is the advancement of the radio art. And what's kind of cool is just listening to the ideas and the things that people are doing. And time again, the people that are in attendance listen to talks and come back the next year and write a paper and present a talk saying, hey, last year I heard this talk and it spurred this idea in me, and here's my work for the past year. So if you go back through the past, this will be the 30th annual. So for the past 29 years, there has been a series of proceedings and talks that have been given, and a lot of it on the bleeding edge of amateur radio. But to help Gary there saying that, you know, this is for the real not faint at heart, I would say that what we've done also is on Saturday, we've created a series of introductory talks. So we have introduction to digital modes, introduction to D-Star. So, Leo, you would like that.
Come on, listen to this.
The introduction to D-Star.
Mm-hmm.
And then introduction to digital HF by Mel Witten, who's Mr. Digital HF himself. And an introduction to APRS from basically the father of APRS, Bob Baringa. Wow. So we have, and also the, you know, we also get asked an awful lot, you know, can we broadcast online the DCC? And, you know, we're kind of working on that. But let me just say that being there is just magical. You know, you're able to rub shoulders and be able to see, meet, and talk with basically the movers and shakers of amateur radio right there in the room with you. So if you can, please attend. Of course, if you're local to the Baltimore area, it's easy for you to get there. If you're not, it'd probably be a little expensive jumping on an airplane at this point. But, I mean, if you've got a lot of frequent flyer miles, you might be able to grab it. But what we do is we rotate around the U.S. We go east, mid, west, and we rotate around. For example, last year we were in the Portland, Oregon area. We were up in Vancouver, Washington, right across the river from Portland. And the year before that, we were in Chicago. And this year, we're going to be in Baltimore. In fact, we're working on Atlanta for 2012. So we move around. And we do that on purpose so that the local people can be able to basically get there easy, walk in, see what it's about. And they end up becoming part of the traveling row show because we got all kinds of people that, that fly in. So think of this as the TED Talks of amateur radio.
And there really are a lot of talks that are understandable at the Midland type ham level. You know, my technology is not so great, but I enjoyed a lot of the talks, and a lot of them were at levels that I could understand. And you've got a banquet speaker on Saturday night, and that is typically not deep technology.
This one sounds really interesting. The Village Telco. I thought, boy, yeah. Anybody who's a fan of technology would love to hear about how David Rowe is wiring up third world communities with free telephone service using Wi-Fi and mesh. And I mean, this just sounds so interesting.
Yeah, and I've heard David's talk, and David is coming to the DCC. He's probably going to get the most traveled award, but Tapper, basically, this is another thing that Tapper does is when we find extraordinary people like this, we'll invite them and we'll pay their way to the DCC. So we funded his travel there so that everybody in the Baltimore area or whoever comes to DC gets the benefit of listening to David because he's got some wonderful things that he's working on. And this Village Telco, he's created this little box and he calls it the Mesh Potato. And he's going to talk about how it's so easy to build one of these. And then the neat thing about his talk is it's also very social. I mean, you can certainly inject a lot of technology into a village, let's say. But what he's done is he's actually showing entrepreneurs how to set up a local telephone company.
Great.
And here's the equipment. And also, it's not that it would be put in there, it'd be free. But actually, you'd put it in there and maintain it and actually charge so that, you know, then a little bit of money goes back into the system and the entrepreneur there benefits. So this is very much a social aspect as well as a technical aspect.
Can't wait. It sounds fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Now,
Steve, we're losing you, but I think this is a good time, don't you think, Gary, to wrap up. And thanks, Steve, for what a fascinating topic.
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah.
And So I will be at the DCC next weekend, 2 weeks, and I will be shooting video of it. And I shot video of it in 2009 and 2010, and they have the whole thing on six DVD sets each year. They did it themselves out in Seattle, too far for me to go last year, but they've got DVDs on their website. So you can look over at my website and their website, the DVDs that are available, and pick by topic because each of the six DVDs has a few of the presentations on it. And you can look at the topics you might be interested in and get a feel for it. But Steve is right. If you can go, the live interaction with these people is what's really good. You can ask questions and between the sessions at lunch, at dinner, talk to people that you've only read their articles in the trade magazines and really learn something and get answers to your questions. So it's worth going to.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your time. You know, the chat room,
glad to do it.
It's great to talk to you. Chat room, Gary, is they've got pitchforks. They've got torches. They are screaming smoke and solder. Smoke and solder. They're dying to hear from George. They want to know what he did with that DC power supply.
Yeah, I have one solution.
Let's go do it.
All right, go ahead.
I'd like to throw out there for the
sure,
satellite.
George.
Next time they go up, if they'll just carry along my rotting lawnmower as an alternate power source, I think would be at full power.
What's the up mass on a riding lawnmower? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah, it'd be pretty high. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at the power supply project.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to another exciting adventure in smoke and solder. If you remember a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was episode 14, we began building a DC power supply. Now this week, we're going to add a regulator to that power supply and make it much more versatile. Before we begin adding the regulator, let's add in our pilot light, which is going to be an LED, and we'll need a resistor in series with that LED because we're going to run this from the 120 volts coming into the supply so that as we vary the voltage with the regulator, it won't vary the brilliance of the LED. Now we'll use Ohm's law, which is I equals E over R. The voltage on our LED is 2.25 volts, and the current is 28 milliamps. So first we'll figure out the resistance of the LED itself. We'll take 2.25 volts and divide it by 0.028. And that tells us that the resistance of the LED is about 80 ohms. Now let's figure out what the resistance needs to be for the whole circuit, including the resistor. We take 120 volts and divide it by 0.028, since the current is the same at all points in a series circuit. And that tells us the R total of the circuit is 4285 ohms. Now we'll subtract the resistance of the LED, which is 80 ohms, from that. And that tells us that the value of our resistor should be 4205. Now, I'm going to use a 10K resistor in here because I don't care to run the LED at full brilliance. So let's try that, 120 volts, divided by 10,080 ohms equals 0.0119 or 12 milliamps. Let's mount the LED to the cabinet. We'll use a LED holder or grommet. Push it in through the front of the cabinet and push the LED in through the rear. Then we'll connect the leads from the LED to our incoming AC on one side. And the other side will go on the fuse holder, which is after the power switch, so the LED goes on and off when we turn on the power. Now let's look back at our schematic we started a couple of weeks ago. The simple DC power supply, we're going to come down from the negative lead and run it to the bottom of our schematic. This is going to be our ground, so we'll put a ground symbol on it. Our regulator is an LM317. It has three leads on it. It has an input, an output, and a control lead, and then the tab on it is ground. We connect the input of the LM317 to our positive voltage from the supply, and we'll put a 0.1 microfarad across the input to ground to prevent any spikes or hash. The output pin of the regulator will go out to the positive terminal on the outside of our power supply. And we'll connect the pot in here for a voltage adjustment. The bottom side of it will go to ground, and the wiper will go to the control leg of the regulator. And then from that point, we'll also run a 240 ohm resistor back to the output of the circuit. And now here's our regulated power supply. We will add one more 22 microfarad capacitor to the output here, and this will give us 0.3 to 30 volts DC. At 1.5 amps out. Now let's mount the potentiometer for the supply. And let's prepare a spot to mount the heat sink. Now the heat sink is one I originally scavenged out of the computer power supply. It had two mounting tabs to mount it to the PC board. I'm going to bend these tabs over and we'll solder it directly to the bottom of the case. We'll use a Dremel tube to rough up a little spot and get down to bare metal so the solder will stick. To connect the terminals of the regulator and the other components that go with it, I'm going to use a small piece of perf board here that I will cut out with an X-Acto saw. We'll install the regulator, two capacitors, and resistor to this little piece of PC board and connect the wires that go to the regulator circuit. Here's our regulator, resistor, 0.1 microfarad capacitor, and 22 microfarad capacitor. Next, I'll mount the regulator assembly to the heat sink, and then we'll solder the heat sink to the case. Now, we'll use a little extra flux in here to make sure that the solder sticks good. And after we're finished, we'll use some denatured alcohol to clean away the excess flux. The areas of the case that we scratched previously with the Dremel tool could rust in the future, so I'm going to paint over that with an aluminum paint pen. And now the moment of truth. I've turned on the power, I don't smell any smoke, and I'm reading 26 volts. I'll turn down the supply all the way and drop to the 2.5 volt scale, and it says that I'm reading approximately 0.3 volts. Now I'll increase the meter to the 50 volt scale. And there's 10 volts, 20 volts, 25 volts, and finally 30 volts. So this supply will go from 0.3 to 30 volts. Let's take one more look at the parts that make up our power supply. First, we have the LED pilot light. We have the potentiometer for voltage control, the negative and the positive output terminals. On the inside, we have the transformer. The AC socket where the power comes in. Now, don't worry, this is unplugged. The fuse holder, the power switch, the bridge rectifier, the filter capacitor, and the voltage regulator assembly. All that remains to be done now is to install the case so that no one electrocutes himself. And I'll also put some rubber feet on the bottom of the case so that I don't scratch up my countertop. And, of course, we want to label the project. So there we have it, the Ham Nation Regulated Power Supply. Hopefully this thing will last me for years, and we'll be seeing it in the future to power many smoke and solder projects.
Wow. I want to know how he solders that fast, because I can't do it that fast.
It's all in the sound effects, I think. You can see more, of course, of George at amateurlogic.tv. Did we lose George? I think
we lost me for a minute.
There he is. Well done, as always, George. The chat room is now mollified.
And we'll look forward to more spoken solder next week. Do you know what you're going to do next week, George?
Oh, we lost his audio. Is his audio?
He said he's going to have some denatured alcohol.
I think that's what I'm going to do right now.
I had my microphone muted. I don't have no idea what I'm going to do next week, but we'll come up with something fun.
It should be fun, absolutely.
Thanks, George.
Got a week to think about it.
It's always great to see you, George. Thank you.
I disappeared again in the middle of Steve Bible. I had a blue screen of death on my little Windows laptop here.
Do you think that's the lightning or just Bill Gates?
Yeah, I think that would be Bill Gates. We do another
Bill.
Thunderstorm rolling in here.
Well, I hope you survive the thunderstorm, and I hope your
Windows
gear,
never
more importantly.
So slowly. Windows never boots so slowly as when you're in a live show waiting for your computer to come back to put you on the program.
The only thing slower than Bill Gates is maybe a little smoke and solder. But we're glad you made it back. Thank you for doing a great job in Bob Heil's absence. Will you be back next week, Gary?
I don't think so. Bob will be back next week. So my next Ham Nation will be the end of September, the last Tuesday in September, the first Tuesday in October. So I'll be back then, and we'll get to that Huntsville Ham Fest video then.
Good. Yeah, the video
so
you shot there.
That's all about.
And, of course,
I was at the Shelby Ham Fest this weekend in Shelby, North Carolina, another big regional Southeastern Ham Fest. Maybe I'll squeeze a little video in from that, too.
You get to have all the fun. You can catch more of George online at arvideonews.com. In fact, there's a few of these AR Video News documentaries on here, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, that DCC thing we were talking about.
Yeah, so. That's great.
Yeah, thank you for the plug.
Of course. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Thanks to Gordon West,
who's my long-distance Elmer.
Well, thank you, Leo. Next week, Don Wilbanks, AE5DW, last seen throwing marshmallows at alligators with Newsline.
Yay! A new feature on the show. Really glad to add that. And once again, don't forget that stumper, that sound. Do you want to play it again? Do you have it rewound there? We can, one more time, we can hear this sound that was coming out of the brand name something or other. Oh, we lost his audio. It's very quiet.
I'm sorry, I had my volume down.
There it is. An annoying sound.
Oh,
what
is that?
It's
a busy signal. Now I recognize it's a busy signal.
So what is that sound?
Email wb6noa@arl.net.
That's right.
And Gordle will read the best answer next week on the show.
And I guess it's time to get out of here. So let me give you my new signature line, Gordon. Over and out.
You can't say
over
that.
And out.
10-4, good buddies.
Thanks, everybody. That'll be your new signature line.
We'll see you next time on Ham Nation 73.
Bye, everybody.
73.